Here goes nothing. Welcome to Season 7, Episode 26 of the Ubuntu Podcast. In this episode, we'll have some interviews. Mark did at JISC, and we'll read your feedback. If you're listening live, you can send us the message using the chat thing on the website and in the UUPC IRC channel. I'm Alan, and joining me this week is Laura.
Hello!
Oh, gosh. So, for those of you who didn't know, last week we had some audio troubles. I think we've fixed them now. Well, more of a workaround than a fix.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, we're now on a single microphone. I think every week something else has gone wrong, so by the time Tony comes back, we'll be down to a single microphone and nothing.
All four of us sat around one microphone. Yeah. So what have you been up to, Laura?
I went to a funeral, but my 11-year-old cousin taught me how to use Instagram. I installed the app and let her set it up for me. And because I'd let her set it up for me, she seemed to think that meant that I didn't know how to use phones, and kept saying things like, "Do you know how to direct message?" So I was like, "Yes."
So what, are you now on Instagram and now you're going to be posting loads of pictures of food and your trainers and bare feet in sand and stuff like that?
No.
Oh, I'm disappointed.
So what have you been up to?
I've been using proprietary software this week.
Ooh.
Yes. I've been using something called Construct 2. It's a Windows development tool for making games, mostly. You can make apps with it, but mostly people use it for making games. I've been playing with it because my kids want to make some games, and they're kind of beyond using Scratch now. They want to make something that's going to be usable on other platforms like their tablets and phones and desktops, and something they can share with their friends. So I had a look at this Construct 2, and the cool thing about it is it's a kind of drag and drop and point and click developer tool, but it's really powerful, and it spits out HTML5. So you can, the resulting code uses like WebGL and all the modern technologies, but it'll run inside a browser on anything, basically on phones, tablets, desktops. It's really, really cool.
Cool.
So I've started making silly little games, which I'm not very good at. And keep an eye out for my rubbish games that will be in a store near you soon, perhaps.
If you're lucky. Okay, shall we listen to Mark's interviews?
And have a cup of tea.
I think so.
Can you tell us a bit about the JISC Summer of Student Innovation?
So the Summer of Student Innovation is a competition that we've run now the second year, where we invite groups of students to pitch a project idea for how they'd like to improve student life, learning and teaching, research, in any way they want using technology. So they pitch an idea on a website we call JISC Elevator, where they do a 2 to 3 minute video presentation.
Uh-huh.
People then vote, and they have to get a threshold number of votes to qualify, 250 votes from 10 institutions to qualify.
Right.
So that selects them down, and then we take the best around 20 of those projects, give them £5,000 each, and invite them along to a summer school where we do 3 times 3 days, working with them and support them with mentors.
Cool. So you said this is the second year that you've done it. So what's your favourite project that came out of the first year of the programme?
Favourite project, that's a hard one. One of the best projects that we've had was a project called Core for Participants, which was about supporting participatory research. They're probably the most mature project.
Mm-hmm.
We've been working with them for the last 12 months to look at developing their website into a new service. Hopefully give you part of the JISC portfolio.
So a successful project as part of the summer schools can actually become a live service used by the UK education sector?
Yes, that's what we're exploring. We're exploring different approaches for how we can make those services. So we can either integrate them into our own portfolio within GISC, or we could support them in some other way. So we might just subscribe to them, service, pay for them, or we may just help them along their way to get some investor funding somewhere else and become a big multi-million pound industry of their own.
Are there any particular themes you see a lot of projects working in similar areas?
I've got a presentation on this. There's been a lot of projects around sort of quantified self last year. We want an app that will tell us how to do this better, how to study better,
right,
monitor my sort of studying skills type stuff. We've had quite a lot of projects this year around assessment, around multiple choice questions, use of, around different methods of learning through assessment. That's quite a strong theme this year. A lot of them are looking around social networking things, an educational version of Facebook,
yep,
something a bit more specific. And then some of them are very student life based. They're just about improving the students' learning experience.
So it's not necessarily about the actual study. Study life is also about the social aspect of student life as well.
Any project that's around either supporting learning and teaching or supporting research.
Oh, right,
or it can be around the student life experience. So we've got one project this year that's about promoting the promoting women in the workplace.
Right.
To give them a positive image in science and technology areas.
So that's what, delivering examples to students of where they can progress from their degree into industry?
Yes, delivering examples of successful women in career pathways, particularly in science and technology. Because we have found that the projects are dominantly male-led.
Right.
Which is, I think, partially a result of sort of technology subject area.
Right, yeah.
Sort of technology and business. We do have some projects.
Mm-hmm.
We're very successful.
Cool. Okay. Well, hopefully I'll get a chance to speak to some of the projects later. If people want to know more about the Summer of Student Innovation, where can they go to find out more?
You have to give me the web address, won't I?
Yep, that's usually what people do. Is the GISC Elevator site a good place to start?
If they look for... go to the GISC website and look for student innovation.
Right, so that's GISC.ac.uk.
GISC.ac.uk/student innovation.
Excellent, thanks very much. I'm at the GISC Summer of Student Innovation Summer School, and I'm talking to Joel Murphy from the Unisaver project. Hello, Joel. How are you doing?
Hi, mate. I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. So, do you want to start off just by telling us a bit about what Unisaver is?
Yeah, sure. Unisaver is an online community,
mm-hmm,
for students, all aimed at saving money.
So how does Unisaver try and save students money, and what sort of thing are they saving money on?
Obviously, like I said, it's an online community,
yep,
so students themselves would post content to my website.
Yep.
And obviously they could vote on the best deals.
Right.
And if they find a better deal, they could resubmit that deal for the product that's been submitted.
Mm-hmm.
And that would show a new deal for that product. The type of products they posted, obviously, so anything a student would use in their everyday life.
Uh-huh.
Anything from university equipment or college equipment, such as pencils, notepads. Things like that. And also food and drink.
Right.
Food and drink.
Yeah.
So say, for example, you're having a party, you want to make the most of that party and make it as cheap as possible.
Yeah.
Take advantage of student discounts and buy in bulk. And that's exactly what the website's aimed at.
Okay.
To give the best.
Pointing out the deals and where you get student discount as well, and where it's going to be cheapest. Right, okay. So what are you doing with Unisaver as part of the summer school?
The project's been funded.
Yeah.
They just helped me develop the idea to make it, you know, more of a success.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just aimed, you know, a better product towards students, really.
Right. So, what sort of things are you trying to do to Unisaver to make it more useful for students?
Enhance the product, you know, make sure it suits the needs of the target audience.
Right, so at the moment you're trying to identify exactly how it is that students will want to use it so that you can then improve it.
Yeah.
Right, cool. Okay, and is the site live at the moment? Can people go and check it out?
There is a website.
Right.
But it's not ready yet.
Okay, then. Well, we won't give out the URL.
Very, very, very early alpha stages.
Okay.
But yeah, definitely. Well, I can give out the URL now, you know, this.
Yeah.
There's nothing on the record screen.
Okay, then.
So, the URL is unisaver.co.uk.
Yep.
.com as well, so for that should be set in.
Okay, so can people go there and submit their tips at the moment?
Not at the moment.
Right. But hopefully over the next few months as you develop part of the Summer of Student Innovation. Mm-hmm. Excellent, okay. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
I'm at the JISC Summer of Student Innovation Summer School, and I'm talking to Joseph MacArthur from the Open Access Button. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
So to start with, for those who might not be familiar with the term, what is Open Access?
Open Access is an alternative to the traditional publishing system. The traditional publishing system, that's a mouthful, the event name, has a tendency to lock information up behind paywalls, behind barriers which stop people accessing it. Open Access is the alternative to that. It's free, immediate online access to scholarly articles with full of reuse rights.
Right, so we're talking about academic publishing and academic journals.
Yeah, the Times won't be open access, but your journal for science or might be.
Right, okay, so how does getting access to an open access paper work differently to getting access to one through traditional methods?
So traditional methods would normally involve you paying in some way for that article. You may see that you pay or you may not. So if you're a big institution like a university, maybe a company, they may buy on your behalf a subscription to lots and lots of journals, and they'll spend thousands, hundreds of thousands, sometimes millions of pounds doing that, so that when you're on their networks, you don't notice that that all of this research has a real cost associated with it. If you don't have one of those institutions backing you, then you'll be asked to pay $20-$30 per article just to read it, sometimes for as little as 24 hours. As you can imagine, is not something that a lot of people can afford, and even big universities struggle to afford all of these subscriptions to the tens of thousands of journals there are.
Mm-hmm.
The difference with open access is that it's funded in a different way, but it allows for anyone to access that research for free.
Right.
Really important.
So is the money which you're paying to access the articles not funding the research? So by taking that away, you would be making the research harder to fund?
In some senses, I think it's probably also important to recognise that all of that money that is spent by subscriptions
yep.
is also taken out of research budgets.
Right. It's money which the universities would otherwise be able to spend themselves on research.
Yes.
Yeah, right.
So it's probably worth just going over how Open Access is funded. So about 70% of journals are funded, are free to publish in. They're funded by sponsorship and by advertisements, just like everything else on the internet, essentially.
Yep.
The other 30%, you pay what's called APCs, article processing charges, which can vary from a few dollars to a few thousand dollars, depending on the journal and the model that they have taken. That money is normally paid by research funders, and often, especially in the UK, research funders like the Wellcome Trust and I think RCUK are now putting pots of money aside that aren't linked really directly to a research budget. It's
uh-huh.
a budget to publish.
Right.
And the important thing is you do that just once.
Mm-hmm.
You then no longer have to pay for that for the rest of human time.
Right. Cool. Okay, so that's a bit about what Open Access is. What's the Open Access Button?
The Open Access Button is a tool that helps track when people are denied access to research
right.
and also works to get people access to that research. About 18 months ago now, me and my friend were doing research for Big Pharma and also at university, and we couldn't get access to the research that we needed, and we were really frustrated. And we were lucky enough then to discover open access, and when we found out about this idea and about how it was kind of starting to become really mainstream, and it was proven that the open access was a viable way of doing scholarly publishing, we were basically really pissed off that you know, traditional publishing was kind of still a thing, and we decided that we came up with this idea of trying to gather those moments of frustration when you hit a paywall, when you're denied access to research, and gathering those up so that everyone could see them. And that those moments of frustration could lead to something much more positive than just going off and being a bit annoyed that you'd spent half an hour searching for something and you no longer could. So we worked with volunteer developers from around the world to build this tool, and we launched it in November to thousands, who are now thousands of users who are busy collecting their stories of being denied access to research, and we've now got about 8,000 of those, and it makes a really strong case.
Cool. So so what's the most sort of interesting or surprising thing that you found out from these stories?
Oh, how long do we have? I mean, it's a really good question. Like, I think just the range of stories that's out there. I guess for us, when we first launched it, we expected to see patients in there who were trying to find out about their conditions. We expected to see doctors and researchers who couldn't access the research they needed. What we didn't expect was school children trying to do their homework.
Wow. Right? Okay.
Like, we didn't expect I don't think we expected the quantity.
Yeah.
The tool to be taken up quite so heavily. I think it was clear that people were really interested in being able to share their stories about this, and in just the way the tool worked, we didn't expect for stories to build quite so naturally. We have users who use it a lot, and you see that. One of the clearest cases is this is a patient who's clearly, you know, trying to find out about their condition, about the drugs they're taking, about, you know, alternatives and the side effects that they're having. And that just builds up a really strong image of, you know, yes, you might hit a paywall once, and that's troublesome and annoying, but what happens when you hit one 10 times?
Yeah.
Right? And what's the real impact of that to a patient's health, to a researcher's, you know, studies, or to a school person doing their homework? And I think we've just been able to show that in a way which was completely impossible before.
Yeah,
in a really organic way. It's
yeah.
Someone sitting down to tell us a story. It's little moments, right? And they're creating something more powerful.
Cool. Okay, so if people wanted to get involved in the Open Access Button project, are you looking for developers, or are you looking for people to contribute in other ways to the project?
Yeah, so we've got the Open Access Button site, which is very Googleable, the openaccessbutton.org, where you can go and start to just take part in actually logging paywalls and really, you know, just using it as part of your research. But of course we are, this research, this project has been done almost entirely off of volunteer development time, and we're still looking for that. We're looking to start a new kind of development cycle in the next month or so, where we'll be looking for volunteer developers. You can go to blogs.openaccessbutton.org to find more information on that and how you can get involved. And yeah, I mean, any support is really, really useful. It's all done off volunteer time. If you can donate, that's also really, really useful, or just connect us with people. It's really been a team effort from a small community of people doing some really spectacular things.
Cool. Well, I hope it goes well in the future. Thanks very much.
Thanks very much, Mark.
And now, oh, with a microphone that works, it's time for command line love. Doesn't sound sexy when I do it.
You need a deeper voice.
Admittedly, I don't think it sounds sexy when Mark does it either. So, yeah, there you go. I'm not into that kind of thing. If you are, fair enough.
Write in and tell us.
Yes. or don't. So Command Line Love was submitted by email from Waldemir Kabala, which is a fabulous name. I hope I didn't murder that too much. And it's actually one that I've seen a couple of times, and someone else posted on Twitter in a random conversation, and I saw it, and it's brilliant.
Mm-hmm. It does what?
It's for spinning up a web server on your machine. Let's say, for example, you want to transfer a file, or you want to open a file that's on your laptop, and you want to open it on your tablet, or you're on your Linux machine, and you need to transfer a file to someone who's on Windows, or but they're on your network.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you're at work or you're at home and you've got two people on the same network. It's a really quick way to transfer files from one place to another by just spinning up a web server. And it's just Python using a module, which, depending upon whether you're running Python 2 or Python 3, there's two different commands. And Python 2, it's Python minus M and then simple HTTP server. And that runs a web server in whatever directory you're currently in. So if you're sat in the directory with whatever files you want to share, you run this command and it starts a web server. So then the other machine, you just open your web browser and point it at the machine that's running the web server.
Okay.
And you just get a directory listing of everything that's in that directory.
Hmm.
And then you can download stuff. So it's real quick and easy because like every machine's got a web browser.
Yes. Yeah.
And most machines have Python. So it's very quick and easy. You just run Python with this command and bam, you've got a web server. Quick and easy way to transfer files.
Neat.
Mm, very. Thank you very much for that, Waldemar.
And now it's time for some feedback.
First of all, we have an email from Daniel Alexanderson. I think that's right.
Mm-hmm.
He says, love the show. Oh, thank you. He says,
I normally edit those bits out.
Yes, we don't relish too much in the compliments. Few and far between as they are. He says, I am curious, though, what operating systems and players do your listeners use to listen to the show? Could you please share some general numbers on what pod fetchers are popular and what share of the audience choose OGG over MP3?
Well, Tony knows the OGG versus MP3 numbers and doesn't tell us.
Oh, I know them too.
He has a stats page somewhere, doesn't he?
Yeah, I know that stats page. In general, I think it's... it used to be that we would get the vast majority of our listeners from iTunes.
Yes.
So the MP3 feed gathered way more listeners. We haven't looked at those stats for a long time. They are generated, and we could. And Tony, every so often, generates a nice graph. Tony likes graphs.
Yeah.
but, yeah, we haven't done it for a while. And it's interesting because we did a bunch of years where we did one episode every 2 weeks. It was an hour long. Remember those times? Remember when we used to do that? Gosh. Remember when we recorded on a Sunday and then edited it and put it out, like, a week later?
Because it took that long to edit it.
Whereas now, it's just like, you know.
Two evenings, it's done. Yeah, bam, bam.
Job done. and now we do them every week. We put them out every week.
Yes.
And that's changed things a little bit in the way that, you know, everyone gets the episode on the day one and then there's a long tail of people getting the episode later.
Yeah.
We get like the double bump because people download the episode every week instead of one big bump every 2 weeks.
Yeah.
But no, we don't really keep an eye on that kind of stuff. We know
Tony does.
Yeah. We know it's about 5,000 per episode or thereabouts.
But it varies over time as well because people still keep downloading it afterwards. So it does go up quite high, the older ones.
Yeah, we got an email from someone who wanted to download the entire archive.
Yes.
What was that for?
Oh, it was someone at work wanted to download the entire back catalogue because they'd come to it partway through and they just, in a kind of pedantic way, wanted to go back to the beginning and start from the beginning. And he was trying to work out all kinds of scripts, trying to make it happen. And it was all based on the numbers of the episodes. But the problem is we use a different number of episodes every time.
Right.
Just because of how the weeks work out. And because then we changed it to two episodes, so the numbers suddenly shot up. And, yeah, it wasn't working. So you came up with a really simple command.
One line.
Was it wget?
Yeah, wget minus M.
Unfortunately, by the time I told him, the night before I told him, he'd managed to get his script working.
Oh. No.
I felt really bad. He says, yeah, that would have worked really well.
And that would have nicely bumped all our stats.
Mm.
Although evenly for every single episode,
yes,
to be fair.
That's true. So, yes.
And Daniel also mentioned a cool new Podfetcher project for the Linux desktop. I have seen this before. It's very cool. It's by Nathan Dyer, and it's called Vocal. And he mentioned that as a possible podcatcher that people might want to use. It's very nice. It's focused on clean design, and it's aimed at the elementary desktop. It's very nice.
Mm-hmm.
Moving on.
Somebody.
I didn't put the name in. Oh, dear.
Okay, well, I'll read it and you find the person's name.
Oh, okay.
So, somebody in said that in Season 7, Episode 22, the command line love, we mentioned SSH minus capital D. Something to do with VPN proxy?
Yes, it's to it's a poor man's proxy to get you to bypass filters that might be on your connection, that kind of thing.
Okay.
And yeah, it's a quick and easy way to implement one of those. Yes.
Okay. And they said you only need root access on your local machine.
Well, they're giving another option, aren't
they? Oh, I see. Yes.
This is
S shuttle.
Yes, S shuttle. Which apparently is in the repo.
Huh. And that's even easier, apparently. You don't need to set up any proxy in your browser, and all your outgoing traffic for the entire computer goes out of your SSH server.
That's even better.
Huh.
That's much better, because that way it's like near zero effort. You just run this command, and you don't have to... Because one of the problems with the SSH minus D is you run that to set up the tunnel, and then you have to tell your browser, right, now send all the traffic through that tunnel.
Right, yes.
Which, if you've already got a browser open and you've already got loads of other apps open and you want all of your app traffic to go out through that connection. So, for example, if you're torrenting, for example, not only do you want the browser to go out through that tunnel so that you pop up somewhere else and see, you know, different results because you're coming from somewhere else, but also you want the torrent traffic potentially to go out through that tunnel as well, maybe. But, yeah. And this, I found the email, and it was from Emilian Klein. And
he says, yes, you do have a Frenchman listening to your podcast.
No, that was another one.
Oh, right.
Oh, no, this is all the same email.
This is all the same email. It's on the same box.
Yes, you're right. Yes, it is. You do have a Frenchman listening to your podcast.
So we know whose name that was.
We do love listening, finding out where people are listening from.
That's brilliant. Especially, we've had some very obscure, like little tiny islands in the middle.
They're not obscure to the people who live there.
Well, I don't know. One was a tiny island in the middle of Pacific or something.
Oh, really?
That was good. They wrote in. I can't remember. Yeah, it was very... Yeah.
Maybe we should, when we look at our stats next, is have a look at, see the GeoIP lookup. I know it's not 100% reliable, but have a look and, you know, spy on our listeners and... No, I meant find out where they live. No, I mean, get aggregated statistics for where they live.
And we don't know anything about your details.
No, we don't want to know.
No.
Unless you tell us, in which case we'd love to know.
Yes. Yes, that would be cool.
I think that's all of your feedback.
We did have another feedback about sound quality.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Was that Ken?
Ken?
I don't know.
I can't remember. I don't know.
I'm just doing that from memory. Emailed us about the sound quality. It was a few episodes ago, but I suspect it was probably like the first one I did, and it was all a bit quiet. Mm. So this week notwithstanding.
I mean, you mean last week?
Last week, this week.
It's all a blur.
Yeah. So 22 and 23, I think, were the last one. No, 23 and 24. What were we on?
25 and 26.
Yeah, so 23 and 24, I actually normalised all the sounds, so I'd be quite interested to know whether you think that was any better. And I'm going to do the same today, hopefully.
You got out your girl's big book of Audacity.
Audacity, yeah. Thanks, O'Reilly.
Excellent. Well, that's all your feedback.
The Ubuntu podcast needs you. Yes, you. If you hear something that enthralls, exasperates, or elevates you, tweet at UUPC or email podcast@ubuntu-uk.org. You can also talk to us on the telephone, Skype, Facebook, and Google+. Find links to all these places on our website, podcast.ubuntu-uk.org. Please do get in touch. I mean it. Just one message, just to know there's someone out there who cares.
And that's it for today. The next live show will be on Wednesday, the 1st of October at 8:30.
In the evening. And not 20:30 UTC, as Mark tweeted from our account earlier today. Silly boy.
Silly boy.
Yeah. But we do get that wrong every time, so it's fine. It's either him getting it wrong or one of us getting it wrong or, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I was going to say that by this time, by next week we'll know whether the Ubuntu UK podcast is a little bit smaller.
Oh, yes. Smaller demographic, yeah.
Yeah, for the UK. But actually, for this show, we should already know.
Yes.
Because this is next week.
Well, we already know, and the answer, well, yes, surprised us.